Chapter Naught, 11 a.m, 26th of December, 1977. I was going to stick it out, and do it cold this time. No drugs to alleviate the symptoms of withdrawal. I had spent a sleepless night, sweating and shivering. Maybe I had slept, and was now dreaming that I hadn't slept, in which case I must be asleep. I turned over, thumped the pillow into shape, and tried to relax. My toes and shins were numb. I tried to check for sensation, first with one foot against the other, then with trembling hands. The harder I tried to steady my hands, the more uncontrollable they became. You'll be all right if you just stay in bed. You don't have to do anything today. You don't have to see anybody, talk to anybody, eat anything or drink anything. Just stay in bed and see it through. It didn't matter if I hadn't slept all night. I could sleep all day. And even if I couldn't sleep today, I would spend the whole week in bed if necessary. That's what I'd do. I felt better. Sat up, reached out for my pipe, picked it up from the ashtray. That was good. I was doing well. I picked up a box of matches, opened it. My hands were only shaking slightly. I lit my pipe, shook the match to put it out and tried to blow it out. Dropped my pipe, threw the match into the ashtray and watched it burn out. I picked up my pipe and tried to put it in the ashtray and missed by a couple of inches, knocking the ashtray onto the floor. Forget about the pipe and the ashtray. Nothing's burning. Leave them. I relaxed back onto my pillow, but dodged suddenly as an anglepoise lamp prepared to attack me, but then didn't. It stayed where it was. The terrible itching started again. I remembered now. That was what had been keeping me awake. There were insects all over me. In the hall outside, I could hear the clock, the soft, comforting, regular tock. There was no tick. The clock was just saying, tock. I listened hard for the tick. It wasn't there, and of course I knew why. I had become so infuriated at the regularity of its thumping message, not tick-tock, but breeze block, breeze block, breeze block. I'd even tried to change it to teapot, teapot, that I'd carried the clock into another room, covered it with pillows, and gone back to bed, closing both doors. That was why I could only hear the soft, distant tock, 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 tick-tock, 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 breeze block. Breeze block. Oh, Christ, leave me alone. I buried my head in the pillows. I could hear nothing. I listened hard. Nothing. Except the distant breeze block. Breeze block. I sat up. The bedroom door was open. The clock still on the landing. I remembered bumping into it as I lurched past it after throwing up the last time. And the pillows, they were still on the bed. It must have been a dream. So I had slept. Right then. I'll get up and go downstairs and just spend the rest of the day watching television. There's going to be no one around except John, David and Batch. They've all seen me with the shakes before and I've told everyone else that I'll be away for Christmas. When you're not sure whether you're going to throw up or not, the last thing you need is someone fussing. Are you all right? You look a bit pale. Would you like a nice cup of tea and perhaps a thin slice of toast with a poached egg on top? I was about to make the decision to get out of bed when David came in and asked me how I was. And was there anything I wanted, like a nice... No, I snapped. But the words for the rest of the sentence, though formed in my head, just would not articulate themselves. I'll get up, be fine. Dishy water? Yes. He plumped up the duvet. I flinched. It was out to get me in league with the clock and the table lamp and the pipe and the ashtray and the matches. You just stay there, he said, and very sensibly left the room. David, curtains, light. The curtains were still drawn, but there was a chink at the top through which a laser beam from the outside world was threatening me. Oh, fuck all this. You'll be all right. Pull yourself together, man. Get dressed. I threw off the stifling duvet and sat up with my feet on the floor. I slowly dressed, clutching onto anything that I could find for support, lurching around the room. I drew the curtains and felt better. Nothing in the room was moving except for me. I picked up my pipe and lit it. This simple, for me, automatic action gave me confidence. I composed myself. Usually, about half an hour after getting up in the morning, if I hadn't managed to down at least 5 measures of gin, there would be the coughing fit accompanied by the dry heaves, the coughing, the cold sweat, the uncontrollable shivering. But it was 11:30. Perhaps I'd stayed in bed long enough to miss out this daily genuflection and regurgitative prayer to the lavatory bowl. The bedroom doorpost took a swipe at me as I walked past, a mild hallucination. I steadied myself for my walk down the stairs, stairs which I knew either stopped before I finished going down them or carried on after I'd stopped, with banisters that were never quite in the same place, corner posts that made sudden lunges at me, hoping that I would lose concentration and bang my head on shadows. But I was too quick for the shadows and ducked, only to walk straight into a right-hand uppercut from the corner post which had got round me with its clever footwork. Back to bed. 44 hours of febrile paranoia and auditory and tactile hallucinations followed in that restless bed. Sheer exhaustion won, and I slept for a few hours. And I knew that I'd slept this time. I'd sweated it out. The worst was over. Even the stairs had suspended hostilities. I managed to drink a cup of tea, keep down some vitamin pills, and a slice of toast with a poached egg on it. I was free. I went into the dining room. Quite calmly walked past three shelves of Christmas booze and rang Bernard and Jane, my secretary, to ask them round for a drink. Provided, I added smugly, they could stand the sight of me drinking tonic water. They came round to the house. I poured them a drink while apologising for slightly trembling hands. They were both pleased that I'd recovered so quickly, and as I poured myself a neat, slimline tonic, I explained to them how much more confident I was of staying off alcohol for good now that I'd done it the hard way. As I picked up my drink, I knocked over a Christmas card. I put my glass down and tried to stand the Christmas card up again. My fingers wouldn't keep still. "Don't bother about that," said Bernard. "Sit down." I was bothered about it. It was the only thing that mattered. I had to stand that Christmas card up. The harder I tried, the worse I shook. "I'm all right." The shaking was now a rhythmic shuddering, which turned into a sudden spasm, and I fell to the ground, taking with me a pile of glasses, bottles, and Bernard. I woke up to flashing blue lights. There was an ambulance outside. What was that doing there? I felt fine. I'd had worse cuts. Everyone persuaded me that perhaps hospital was the best thing. Jane was gaping as though she'd just been witness to an exorcism. I was carried off to the hospital knowing that I'd lost my heroic struggle with the distilleries of the world. Perhaps two bottles of gin a day was hitting the stuff a bit hard. Bernard later pointed out to me that over the last 6 months, because I'd been buying in bulk, I had moved on to the pub-size bottles, that is, 40 fluid ounces each, making an average daily consumption of 4 pints imperial, 2.5 US quarts. It was enough to preserve a cadaver or kill 6 encratites. St. Alvar's Hospital probably had some well-equipped and modern wards, and parts of it may well be the very best in the land, but I was taken to none of these bits. I was destined for the national health as it really is parts of the edifice of healing. Dingy corridors, overcrowded wards, underworked staff, Hogarthian inmates, Boadicean plumbing, and a television that you had to pedal. Quantities of blood were taken for analysis. I was pumped full of vitamins and drugged up to my toupee with heminevrin and valium. But the Rasputin in me cut through the fog of sedation like a bottle of Cutty Sark. I knew that I was not living in the style to which I'd been accustomed and decided that those who could pay for medicine should. I was taken to a private clinic, in which there was, luckily, one Arab-free bed. My personal physician and hard-drinking companion, his efficaciousness, A.R. Bailey, the practical, member of the Royal College of Physicians, said, "Right, we'll start the treatment. Your liver function tests were appalling, 10 times over the acceptable norm for the gamma GTP, for instance. But there's no sign of enlargement, and with a bit of luck, there's a chance that you may not have damaged your liver permanently. We'll phase out the heminevrin and valium gradually, and you can take one Abstem tablet in the morning and one in the evening so that if you do drink any alcohol, you'll feel as ill as you were 5 days ago. It's up to you whether you drink or not. It's your liver. It's your life." Dr. Bailey left me valiumed up a treat, along with the children, whose little faces shone with anticipation as in came Puss, followed by Dick Whittington. "Oh, dear, Puss," said Dick. "London is far behind us. What shall we do now?"
"Meow."
"What's that? Sing a song."
"Meow."
"What now, for all the children?"
"Meow."
"Shall we sing a song, children?"
"Yes."
The words were lowered from the ceiling, and as the band struck up the March of the Liberty Bell, we all joined in the song. "Of all the organs the body contains, the liver's the one for me. It processes food, it deals with the waste, it's cleverer than a knee. When it throws up its hands at alcohol and makes you extremely ill, it's best to take heed, you're not being a weed, you're just being sensible."
"Dizzy Gillespie wrote that," I said.
"He may have done, but Fenchurch Street Station is mine. So, Jane, that's £150 you owe me," said Bernard.
"You've only got 2 stations," said Jane. "I bought Marylebone from you last time you landed on Graham's Hotel in Old Kent Road. Oh, well, that's me out, then.
No, it isn't. There's still plenty of property you can mortgage.
I'm not going to mortgage those. I'm going to build there. You haven't got any money.
All right, I'll give you the waterworks.
I don't want it.
Perhaps Graham does.
Graham, do you want the waterworks?
Graham?
No, I'll buy the camelopard.
What?
It's a camel that looks like a leopard.
A giraffe.
He's gone again, said Bernard.
A pantomime. Dizzy Gillespie, camelopard. I was clearly making a good recovery. Even without alcohol, I was thinking irrationally. And generally being an odd sort of fellow, don't you know? What ho, old chap, how's the gazebo?
Do you know, last time I was in Paris, I really did ring Jean-Paul Sartre, and Simon de Beauvoir answered the phone and said that he was out distributing leaflets. Or was that a sketch? Leaving that side of my mind to play around with itself for a while, the rest of it brought itself up to date. I was feeling good. My self-imposed treatment was over. With the use of alcohol, I had managed to kill exactly the number of brain cells I had decided to lose at the age of 22 without sacrificing my liver. There's no doubt that an excess of alcohol accelerates the death of brain cells and that in small doses, as with any other anesthetic, it can temporarily put them out of action, starting at the top and working down the central nervous system. It's the inhibitory influences of the higher centers of the brain which are first affected. That's why alcohol is so commonly used as an aid to social intercourse. It can help you say hello to new friends, goodbye to old friends, do you want to come back to my place to strangers, or why don't you fuck off to tediosities? If you're on to assert, the last thing you need is something nagging away at the front of your brain saying, perhaps another time, with someone else. Anyway, might laugh at my willy. What you need is another pint. To cure my own inhibitions, however, I had discovered a long time ago that another pint and then another was not enough. I was interested in something more permanent. I needed to rid myself of my cramping fetters forever. I had prescribed an extensive course of heavy drinking in order to actually kill off offending nerve cells, a hazardous treatment in that some of the more useful cells, those responsible for keeping oneself within the limits of socially acceptable behaviour, also received a heavy battering. So, what could have been the story of a kind-hearted, respectable medical practitioner isn't.